Can only a real form.
Shaven-headed corpse of our Gurkha dead. I searched everywhere for the body of Steve, expecting to recognize him easily from his thick, dark brown, wavy head of hair. Wherever I looked, there were only shaven heads to be seen amongst the ranks of our dead on Tiger. Perhaps Steve had only been wounded and had been taken away alive when the Japs withdrew to be used as a live dummy for a bayonet training. And then I came across the corpse of one of our men that was lying only two arms' lengths from the firing slits of one of the forward bunkers. This corpse seemed rather larger than the others, but of the same translucent black colour. Could this be Steve? I looked more closely and found that this particular corpse was lying very slightly on its right side, and then I saw a yellow lead pencil sticking out from the top of the corpse's left breast battle dress blouse pocket. A yellow pencil stuck in that particular pocket was Steve's hallmark. He always carried them so. I looked again for the sign of his thick hair on the corpse's head. There appeared to be only a shaven pate. I now very, very tenderly and gingerly turned the body over onto its back and found underneath where its head had been lying on the ground that there was indeed a lot of thick, dark hair embedded in the damp ground. This body could only be Steve's, and the apparent lack of hair on my initial inspection was due to the decomposing skin of the head having shed his hair in that process of disintegration. His poor belly was wide open with his entrails exposed. He had probably been hit by an LMG burst. Steve was still wearing his signet ring on one of his fingers of his left hand, and I thought at once that I should take it from him so that Reggie could send it to his widow. With the greatest of care, I started the awful task of taking the ring from Steve's decomposing finger. I had got it partly off, and the skin of his finger came away from its bone, and skin and ring fell away together into his exposed entrails. I was nearly sick on the spot. With the ring now out of my sight inside Steve's poor body, I had neither the heart nor the courage to delve inside my friend to recover the ring. I decided there and then that the ring must remain with Steve and that it should be buried with him when he was laid to rest very shortly, together with his Gurkha comrades from his C Company on the summit of Tiger. We withdrew now from Tiger, and I returned very sadly to report to Reggie on 1267. As we were withdrawing, we came across a badly wounded rifleman from B Company who had been hiding from the Japs for the past 4 days on the lower slopes of Tiger. We took him back with us, and he was very quickly sent north to hospital in Chittagong. I cannot recall now whether or not this poor lad returned to the battalion later. On receiving my report that Tiger was clear of Japs, Colonel Reggie told Dickie Clark to check at once whether 1433 had been similarly evacuated. It had, and, much to our joy, we knew that Reggie had won at last his carefully planned battle. He was given an immediate DSO, which pleased the 3rd Battalion greatly. And why have I written about Steve at some length in this journal? This is our final journal before the 2nd Gurkhas depart from the army list. Very few members of the regiment who will read this journal have ever heard of his name. I wanted in this final journal to let all of you know, to let all of you in the regiment know of him, and to understand how he died on Tiger nearly half a century ago. He died, as I said earlier, two arms' lengths away from that Jap bunker. No one, apart from his small party from C Company, who went with him to help B Company on Tiger, saw exactly what he did. Those Gurkhas cannot tell us his story, because they all died too on that ill-starred morning. But for my money, and with my intimate knowledge of Steve as a friend, and my familiarity gained by experience of the Japanese soldier as an indomitable fighting man, I would say to you that Steve's actions on the morning of 8 September 1944 were the stuff of which VCs are made. My story is, therefore, I hope, a tribute to Steve, who was a British officer fit to lead Gurkhas in battle. Before Steve and B and C Company's dead were buried on Tiger, Reggie had a bronze or copper plate made to be put on the cross on his grave. It was made at IEME workshops at Brigade Headquarters at Longdor. The inscription, drafted by Reggie himself, read as follows. Major J. E. Stevenson, 2GR, killed in action 8-9-44. Our Steve died as he would wish, leading Gurkhas that he loved and served so well. Forever England. When Steve and the others were buried and laid to rest on Tiger, I was not present, as I was out on patrol, but Reggie was there, of course. I was never able to return to Tiger to see and visit Steve's grave, but every year, on both 8 and 12 September, I think of him and remember him as he was. Why did Steve do what he did on Tiger when he went to see if he could help Adrian's B Company? Why did he perhaps attack that bunker single-handed? Why does any good man do what he does in war? I can tell you quite simply. Steve did what he did because he knew who he was and what he was. He was a second Gorkha. Like all good soldiers in all good regiments, his regiment's number meant everything to him. It motivated him to the point of giving his life. A regiment's number can mean so much to fighting men that, at times, the certain knowledge of who one is and what one is makes all the difference between defeat and victory. That same knowledge can make a man go to hell and back if necessary. It can also help him overcome fear, starvation, and utter exhaustion. Unless and until a man has fought in bloody, terrifying battle in a total war against a highly trained, experienced, motivated, and fanatical enemy, he will never truly know the value of his regiment's number. Pride in one's regiment's identity, namely its number, is the greatest battle and war-winning factor I have ever known. I write these words to you after many years of conflict in the hope that you too will one day understand why I feel as I do. Senior officers and others in the Gurkha Brigade have decided to discard our four infantry regiments' numbers from the future title. They do neither themselves nor their regiments any favours by adopting this stand. This decision has the stamp of inexperience marked on it. I know from bitter personal experience that this, their conclusion, is both wrong and dangerous. Those who have made the decision to discard our identity should try to understand why those of us who fought so proudly, so fiercely, and for so long for our treasured identity, both in the war against Japan and Germany, and during subsequent post-war campaigns, believe that an error of choice of title has been made. It is hard for me to explain to them what motivates a fighting soldier in battle, as they have never known the terrifying experience of war. At times of great danger and fear, I believe that a regiment's number forms an invisible cord round all its personnel. If I may put it this way, that cord can act as an unseen colour during periods of great danger, such as during retreat or attack, around which men can rally and give of their best. Those who have themselves fought in battle will understand my meaning. Those who have not had such an experience may consider my views an exaggeration. They would be wrong to do so without having ever known war themselves, together with all its accompanying horrors. Discard our numbers, and you will, in my belief, do irreparable damage to our four infantry regiments. The numbers are part of tradition. Tradition must be cherished, not destroyed. When writing these last words, I speak particularly for my dead comrades, such as men like Steve, in both the 3rd and 2nd battalions, whose convictions regarding our regiment's identity I knew so well. And that is just what our leaders in the Gurkha Brigade and serving officers have done. They have discarded our numbers. No comment. Now, as I mentioned earlier, our regimental history gives a poorish outline of the battalion attack on 1433, and there are lots of errors in it. The regimental history says that 17 men were killed, and 74 wounded. Whether those figures are exact or not, I cannot say. I cannot myself now remember what our total casualties were. All I do know is that no Japanese bodies were found after the attack. If you remember, it was initially unsuccessful, and the Japs, therefore, prior to their withdrawal, were able to move their own casualties away and out of sight. There was one young man, a rifleman in A Company, who was put in for a posthumous Victoria Cross. He did a tremendous job, I'd heard at the time, but sadly, nowhere in any of our histories is it recorded what he did do. But I spoke to his company commander, of the day, Dickie Clark, only last year, and he himself has forgotten most of the details of the battle, sadly, but he did say that this rifleman Pirtibal Rai, was a Bren gunner in one of A Company's sections during the attack, and he'd gone in firing his gun from the hip time and time again to attack Jap bunkers and killed a significant number of enemy before he fell dead himself. Well, Dickie Clark presumably initiated the citation for a posthumous Victoria Cross, which I understand Colonel Reggie would have forwarded to higher authority. But since the attack was not initially a success, in those days no unsuccessful action permitted a unit to put a man in for a posthumous VC. And the citation was eventually returned, so my memory recalls, from higher authority, granting him a posthumous Indian Order of Merit, which was permissible, and was at one stage the equivalent of the Indian Army's VC. And he did get a medal for his brave pains, but it was sad we all thought that he couldn't have got a posthumous VC. Now I gather the regulations are different, and men can, for unsuccessful actions, still be granted a VC posthumously, provided higher authority approves. I underline the terrible condition our men's dead bodies were in on Tiger, principally because I've never before and never since seen bodies in such a state. Two Jap bodies were found on two separate occasions by me, and they bore a totally different look. First body we found, it was complete, still in uniform, without a weapon, of course. I found him on the eastern slopes of 904 during a patrol prior to the 1433 Tiger attacks, and he was lying on the side of a track we were patrolling down. And the colour of his body was perfectly normal. Is a pale, deathly pallor, as one would expect, but no trace of blackness. And there was no translucent look about the colour of his body. Another Jap body I found, which had already been buried. This is on Maybourne Peninsula, some months later. And all that appeared of his, to my sight, was his foot sticking out of his grave. Presumably village dogs had tried to dig him up, but the colour of that foot was perfectly normal, so why dead on Tiger should have looked so incredible, I simply cannot think. Maybe a doctor would be able to provide the answer, but I've never seen such grotesque dead bodies before or since. After our occupation eventually of Point 1433 and Tiger, extensive patrolling was carried out to the south, southeast, and southwest, and all evidence suggested that 55 Div were withdrawing now from North Arakan, leaving covering parties to delay our 25 Div's pursuit. On 19 October, B Company moved down from the Mayo Range to West Chiradan on the Canbian Chong on the paddy fields. A few days later, the rest of the battalion moved down to the low ground with TAC HQ and Headquarter Company in East Chiradan, and the other rifle companies dug in the area of the village of Nurulapara. On 27 October, General Taffy Davis held his last parade at East Chiradan to present gallantry award ribbons to the battalion for actions which had taken place before the Mayu Range fighting. Shortly after this, he was invalided back to India, handing over command of the division to General Sam Wood of the Dorsets. On the parade at East Chiradan, Reggie Hatton commanded 32nd Gorkhas for the last time. He was promoted to brigadier and left to command 51 Brigade in the division. Philip Panton took over as commandant 32nd Gorkhas, and Adrian Hayter took over as second-in-command. I took over command of B Company on 20 November. 15 Corps' plan, dates were subsequently altered, was to drive down the Arakan Peninsula now, followed by the capture of Akab Island. 12 December was selected as a tentative date for the opening of the offensive, with the final assault on Akab to be mounted not later than 16 February 45. 81 and 82 West African divisions were to carry out a left hook along the Caledan Valley to the east of the Calapansin and Mayu rivers. 26 Indian Division, with 3 Commando Brigade, would carry out the seaborne landing on Akab. 25 Div were to clear the Arakan Peninsula to the east and west of the Mayu Range, a straight run of some 50 miles, to Fowl Point. 74 Brigade were given until 15 January to reach this objective. The advance to the Ton Chong was led by 32nd Gorkhas initially, with regular night patrols by B Company from West Chiradan preceding the start of Operation Alpha, the clearing of the paddy area between the Chiradans and the Ton Chong. On 3 December, 1410 Baluch took over advance guard, and by 9 December we were dug in on the Ton Chong, somewhere north of Minlot. B Company was dug in on the high ground covering the jeep track to Don Bike and a chong, a wide chong, leading east into the Mayo Range. 9 December was my 23rd birthday, and after early morning stand down, after having registered our 2-inch mortar DF tasks, platoon by platoon, I went to have my food, my breakfast, and I found that a childhood friend, John Gamble, who is now our adjutant, had kindly sent me a gift of some form of food as a birthday present. I opened up this packet of food, and I found something which looked very like grape nuts. And never having eaten grape nuts before as a child, I thought I would sample these. So I poured them into my mess tin, sprinkled a lot of sugar over, and poured some condensed milk on top, and tucked into my birthday breakfast. When I came to taste the present, I must say it had a very weird taste indeed. And later that day, when I was called to TAC HQ to be given orders for a patrol, I thanked John Gamble for his presence and told him that, quite frankly, they hadn't tasted very good. He said, how did you cook them? I said, I didn't cook them. I said, I poured milk and sugar of them. He said, you bloody fool. You know what they were? I said, no. He said, they were desiccated beef mince, and you were supposed to cook them and eat them with rice. Well, I didn't know, and nobody told me, but I must say it's a very disappointing breakfast for my birthday. But I didn't look a gift horse in the mouth, and I thanked my old chum kindly for his gift. Later that day, as a result of my orders, I took out a two-platoon fighting patrol up the Chong towards the Mayu Range, and accompanying me was an Australian major, infantry major, who had come from New Guinea to see how operations were progressing in Burma, and he was at this stage visiting our division in Arakan. And we set off together, this two-platoon fighting patrol, and I asked him, would he be kind enough, as he was clearly a very experienced soldier, to comment either favourably or unfavourably on my company's movements, compared with the drills that they in his company adopted during the fighting in New Guinea. At the end of our patrol, which was without any event at all, he said that, in fact, the drills we were using then were almost identical to the drills he used in his company, which was very interesting, because of all the soldiers who fought the Japanese, I reckon that the diggers had probably the best reputation of all. Certainly the Japanese had a high regard for them, and deservedly so. So that was pleasing to know that we were at least, although my company was led by someone like myself with no training at all, we weren't doing too many things that were too very wrong. Shortly after, probably the following day, our advance south continued. And we passed through Minlut, where D Company had a brief encounter with a small party of Japanese, which is recorded in our regimental history, but I cannot honestly say that I recall the incident myself. Apart from that, there was no contact with the enemy at all. We reached Don Baik on Christmas Day 44, which is 10 miles approximately north of Foul Point, and we were dug in on almost on the seashore. And once again, I had a disappointment over my Christmas dinner, just like my birthday breakfast. John Gamble had again told me to come to Attack HQ Mess, which is within spitting distance of my company, to eat roast duck, which they were having for Christmas dinner. So I told my orderly in the afternoon that I would not require any food that evening, but would go off before last light, eat a quick supper and tack HQ, and then come back just getting dark. And that I did. However, there was a tidal chong between my company position and tack HQ. Although the distance was nothing, this was an obstacle. When I got with about half an hour of daylight, maybe a little bit longer, to spare, I found the chong was full of water, the tide was in, so I couldn't get across for my Christmas dinner, so I went back and had some American K rations for my tucker instead. Very disappointing. On Boxing Day, the advance south continued. 3rd, 2nd Gurkhas digging in just north of Foul Point on the 1st of January 1945. The whole time we were moving down the Mayu Peninsula, we dug in on each occasion down to kneeling positions. We didn't have the time to dig full standing positions or put up any form of head cover. And these positions, of course, had to be filled in before we moved on, because in the first Arakan campaign, apparently, own troops had come to grief very often once the retreat had been enforced on them by the Japanese. When they got to their former old positions in the retreat northwards, they found that the Japanese were very often occupying own troops' carefully dug positions. So own troops had to attack their own former positions in order to eject the Japanese. So an order was given to us by division, I expect, that during this particular advance south, we would not leave any uncovered, open positions, just in case our luck ran out and we in turn had to retreat. But it was very, very hard work for the riflemen digging in, sometimes on very stony ground, and then filling the damned holes in and after that before moving off in the morning. On this 1st of January, I had, as I very often did, a medical inspection of my men, and I found, alarmingly, they were all going down with bad doses of ringworm, particularly in their crutches and in their armpits. And that clearly was going to be a problem for the future, because the dirtier men remained, the more difficult those sort of ailments were to clear up. And we had also, on this particular day, a most tragic accident. Once more, I was checking the two-inch mortar DF tasks being registered, and I had gone to 5 and 6 platoons. They'd fired their registration tasks and everything was well. And when four platoon were firing their ranging rounds, I was standing with my company second in command, Subedar Tikajit Pun, within feet of the 2-inch mortar. And there are a number of men in four platoon grouped round the 2-inch mortar pit, cleaning their weapons. And one rogue round exploded prematurely about, what's those, 2 or 3 feet above the mortar's muzzle. And seven of us, including myself, were hit. One very good young NCO, Lance Naik Chalbaragurung, who had performed splendidly with Ronnie Green at the garden incident at Yawatiki I just referred to. He was killed outright. And the 2-inch number one had a large hole cut in his skull, but after hospitalization he did return to the battalion fit and well. And the other wounded were, like myself, no one was in any danger at all. I got a hole in my neck and on the right side and in my waist. But I tied a first field dressing round my neck, and apart from a stiff neck and some soreness, I had no problems to contend with. During our advance to Foul Point, our resupply had been from the sea by landing craft from St. Martin's Island, 10 miles off the coast. The surf, however, often imposed delays in the offloading stores, and particularly delays in our advance because our transport couldn't get across many chongs when the tide was in. Despite such delays and many difficulties in getting our wheeled transport over the chongs, 25 days advance had been much, much quicker than anticipated, largely due, of course, to the almost total lack of Jap opposition. 25 Div's easy progress led to a major change in the Corps Commander's plans. Instead of bringing down 26th Division, which had been training at Cox's Bazaar for the seaborne assault on Akab, it was decided that 25 Div would continue its drive and, together with 3 Commando Brigade, cross from Foul Point to seize Akab. On 1 January, a gunner aero P pilot, I think he was either a captain or a major, Jimmy Jarrett by name, flew over Akab Island and found that the enemy defences appeared to be all unmanned. He saw a large crowd of villagers on the airfield waving white flags and Union Jacks. The airfield was mined, but there was a usable landing ground on the village green, where Jarrett put down his Auster, realising, of course, that the friendly crowd he had seen might have been a deception plot by the Japs. Having landed, Jarrett was told that the enemy had indeed gone. He took off again and reported back to 25 Div. Corps headquarters, however, remained unconvinced, and it seemed that the bombardment and invasion would go ahead as planned. Until it was agreed that if Jarrett went back to Akab and returned from the island with the headman, to be questioned by Corps intelligence, the invasion would probably be called off. A formidable force had been mustered,